Welcome to TalentWise, the definitive podcast for CXOs, human resource and learning and development leaders. This show comes to you from thought leaders who talk about human capital development in today's organization. How to engage and empower today's employee to be effective, competitive and relevant. Stay with us for an exciting conversation with our guest and learn how to future-proof your team. I'm your host Shubhanjan, founder of KnowledgeBridge.
But a more fundamental question remains. In a gig economy, how do you define a team when the team is not necessarily the home team? These workers ultimately need not have conventional loyalty towards the organization. If people simply move from project to project, then, as mentioned by one of our guests on the show, the whole work ethic becomes dependent on an input-output measure. In such a situation, it would be extremely difficult to establish some connect or alignment with broader goals of the organization. And as this remoting and the gig economy becomes the norm, more and more workers move from an organized sector to an unorganized sector. This, of course, brings in other problems in terms of labor laws and so on. But more importantly, who takes responsibility for the training? It seems it's either up to the individual or perhaps the government or some appointed body, because I'm not sure that the organization can see long-term benefits in investing in training a worker who might just move on. If training is then largely left up to the individual and organizations refuse to take responsibility beyond a point, the question then arises, how does the individual prepare herself?
It has been one exciting, invigorating and learning journey this past 13 weeks of TalentWise. We featured 11 remarkable guests and spoke with numerous experts in the process. Today, we wanted to bring you some of those behind-the-scenes discussions along with my colleague Rajiv Aditya, the producer of TalentWise, and the director of Content KnowledgeBridge. We hope to cover some of the interesting learnings and vexing challenges that daunt us in future-proofing our teams. Now, on to the episode. Good afternoon, Rajiv.
Hello, good afternoon.
This has been a very interesting 3 months when we embarked upon this new show, TalentWise. And we have had the privilege of talking to some very fine minds who can talk about where work is headed. And you have had the opportunity to talk to a lot more. I mean, a lot of people who we have not featured, but we have discussed and we have taken inputs from. Today, I wanted to do something different. I wanted to sort of gather those points which we have seen, but somehow have possibly not represented in the show. And have a chat with you as to how you see the issues lined up. So what would you say have been your takeaway in the last 13 weeks?
Well, for one thing, there has been a lot of great inputs from guests we have already featured as well. Certainly, when we look back at our discussions with guests, there are at least two things that stand out in bold. One is the disruption that is happening in the workspace due to technological innovations. And of course, along with that, the uncertainties it brings in terms of job losses or new job creations. The other thing that stands out is how we may define the team. When we say future-proofing the team, possibly the notion of a team seems to need some redefining in terms of where we are headed in the workspace.
So, okay, let's start with the jobs. So, at one side, we definitely see that certain kinds of jobs will not exist anymore, simply because softwares will take over those activities more efficiently. And those are also base-level capabilities, which humans are doing today. Where do you see this whole job scenario headed? So, from what you have understood, that what kind of jobs are getting lost, what kinds of jobs are actually going to be created?
So, like you mentioned, the jobs that are going to go away first are obviously jobs that are very mechanical and have been handled by human beings as grunt work. So, those jobs are going to go away first. But we are not really in a position possibly to say that, you know, these are the kinds of jobs that will remain valid. We are not so sure anymore in the light of the fact that AI is taking over even some of the more complex tasks that human beings were doing earlier. What we can possibly be looking at is to try and tell ourselves, what are the kind of jobs that will remain or get created, or what are the new kinds of jobs that are likely to take center stage? For example, we can think of what are the grave concerns of our society today. I think jobs are going to be created and jobs are going to stay in those areas. Let me mention food, ecology, climate change, biodiversity, water resources, alternative and clean energy. These are some of the grave concerns of our society today. The other areas, of course, would be medicine and health, especially in areas such as, let's say, tissue engineering, genetics, cancer research, nanotechnology, and other such new age biotech. These will all be very big. In fact, if you look at some of the investments being made by the VCs these days, you'll see that there's a lot being invested in new age biotech besides artificial intelligence. These seem to be two areas where there's a lot of investment happening. Food, I guess, will have to be grown in labs because we'll run out of the conventional resources such as land to make enough food for people. Lab-grown meat is already a success to a large extent. I think they're just fixing the taste till it becomes indistinguishable from real meat. It's only a matter of time because before it becomes industrially viable also to produce in large scale. In the farm too, there will be some genetic modifications to crops. Research will aim to produce high-yielding pest and disease-resistant crops. At the same time, there will hopefully be some desire to retain heirloom or traditional varieties of crops, such as, not just as scientific curiosities, but also because they hold unique properties, and biodiversity seems to be an important component in maintaining ecological balance.
Well, there are a lot of other things happening as well. I mean, you mentioned lab-grown meat. There is also a whole revolution happening around hydroponics, right?
Right.
And that's literally growing plants without the soil being the intermediary, but directly feeding them nutrients through flowing water. A lot of the problems, including pests that you mentioned, are because of the uniqueness of plants being grown in the soil. If you take that component out, a lot of things are going to change. And again, technology is going to play a major role, which means that traditional farmers can get retrained. Maybe new kinds of farmers will come. And most importantly, the entire agriculture, or a large chunk of the agriculture, is going to move to cities, because these will be requiring much lesser space, will be actually, food will be grown in buildings. Anyway, let me get back to AI. See, one of the things, I don't know whether you remember in the episode with Dr. Sridhar Mitta, of founder of Next Wealth, he had mentioned that for a long time, the AI that we are talking of will need training on large data sets, which themselves, the data sets themselves, will need human intervention to annotate, to describe what that picture or what that word or what that line means for the AI to train itself. So according to him, a lot of jobs will be actually created because of AI.
Well, that's true at this moment. But there is also, there are two kinds of concerns here. Concern number one is that there is already talk amongst developing nations that countries like India or Bangladesh are the sweatshops of the AI companies, in much the same way to what the fashion industry has been doing. So in Bangladesh, you know, cheap clothes are made and they're sold for a lot of money in the developed nations. So people are concerned that it's the same with AI, and there is a whole set of people who are working on this exact function of tagging, cleaning up, writing metadata, and rendering it into a form that can be used for AI. So that's one concern.
Now, why is that a concern? Because, I mean, I understand the fashion industry bit, but why is it a concern in AI? Because, I mean, honestly, in the beginning of the whole technology revolution, as far as India is concerned, our entire growth came on the back of Y2K. And Y2K was pretty similar. It was very base level code checking exercise, which millions of people did for the rest of the world. So it's still creating jobs, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the concern that is being expressed in this particular instance is coming from the developed nations, from people who are conscious about not exploiting less privileged people. But like you've mentioned, for even for Bangladesh today, it's better than them not having that at all. And that thought has been expressed by many people that, well, while the developed nations can be very concerned about these people not getting paid enough, they are, by standards in underdeveloped nations, they are getting paid well enough. But of course, whether that's good enough is a whole other debate. But the concern in this particular instance comes from developed nations who, like in the case of coffee, would perhaps want a fair trade certification for AI as well. They are concerned whether the AI data is being produced under fair circumstances. The other concern is something that we should be in India concerned about, and that is that there is talk about a new kind of database that will be coming in, which you can work with live. The original system of working with data has been something called ETL, extract, transform, load, and that whole process might become redundant when you work with this new kind of database. If that happens, it remains to be seen how much of tagging and cleaning up will be required. There is a concern that some of the jobs that now have been created because we need to do this kind of cleaning up will no longer remain with this new data set and new structure.
Okay. And by the way, I mean, if it is a discussion about technology, I would pretty much believe that whatever is being told, most of it will be achievable. Going by whatever we have seen in the past, so sure, that's a area of concern.
So just one more thing that I would like to add here is that although I'm not familiar with the technicalities of how machine learning works, in a recent discussion I was having with a data scientist from Lyft, he was mentioning that for whatever reason, adding one more layer of iteration in machine learning is producing results far better than they would have guessed it would have. So in other words, they don't understand why the results are so good. Which brings me to the thought that in due course, this idea of training will become less and less relevant because the datasets will be good enough to produce results far beyond expectations.
I can also vouch for that. I have had discussions with companies who are working with, in the medical field, for example, trying to identify whether algorithms can identify a patient with MS. And their result was much beyond what they'd expected. So I think there are a few areas where the output will be greater than what is expected. And it's also because I think we are learning quite a bit.
The risk, of course, is that a lot of jobs will be lost as well. And if you go by what Yuval Noah Harari has been saying for quite a while, the AI revolution will not be anything like the French Revolution, for instance. So it won't come on a fixed date or even a year. It's not as if you know, 2020 is going to be a year of major upheaval, and then there is a period of adjustment which follows, and then there is a new equilibrium. That's not how it's going to work. Rather, it will be a continuous process of change, and that change is already happening. But this change will keep on accelerating because we are nowhere near the true potential of AI. So we don't know what's going to happen. And what this portends is a great amount of uncertainty and unpredictability about what the future holds. So Harari, you know, he gives the example of a truck driver who finds that he's redundant because now trucks have become driverless. So he reinvents himself as a yoga instructor. 5 or 10 years down the line, he finds that he's redundant again because now AI bots that can track human health, exercise, down to minute details of muscle movement and physiological functions can instruct us far better on exercise than any human yoga teacher can. So now he has to reinvent himself all over again. So this seems to be the biggest predicament in trying to future-proof anyone today. We just don't know what to gear up for, except probably to tell everyone to learn AI or associated data sciences.
Let's take a quick break.
You are listening to a Show How To audio original. Podcasting is one of the fastest growing content marketing avenues today. We can help you exploit this largely untapped marketing opportunity. We can craft your audio strategy and leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that smartphone penetration provides. It is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to target audiences.
Welcome back. Let's continue with our discussion. The core difference of what is happening today vis-a-vis what happened, say, 50 years back, if you recall our previous generation, it was not strange to find somebody who has worked in the same company or in the same factory for their entire lives. People went in to a factory at the age of 20, 22 or whatever, and they retired at 55 or 60. And those are not uncommon. However, in our generation, we have seen that we have not only changed jobs, but we have actually shifted careers. An engineer has become a social entrepreneur, has become a teacher. So the only difference is not that change or entire shift of career. It's just the pace. I think the whole issue is about the rapidity of the change. It's not that change didn't happen in the past. I mean, we have dealt with such issues. One point I would like to bring up is about this whole scenario about unattached workers, the gig economy, remote working, telecommuting, so on and so forth. We have moved significantly to the area where we said that one can work from home for a certain number of days, give flexibility to people, let people work at their own time as long as jobs can be delivered. So what you are seeing is a shift from there where jobs are actually moving to other geographies. So while you said that I'll not come to office like 40% of the month, I'll work from home, you see that now the organization is able to move your job itself to a completely different location where it will be cheaper and nobody misses anything, right? So that's what Baldwin is talking of in his book.
Right.
So the point is that these are all things in the making. It's just that we had a long time to sort of see the movement. It's like looking at something moving in slow motion. You make a lot more sense of what's going on than when it's actually going in the actual speed, right? So I think part of what we are struggling with, and what I hear from all the discussions I've had, and perhaps you will agree, is that we are suddenly waking up to this enormous speed of change. And obviously, this is the computer era. The oil of our generation is computing power, and it will be technology driven. So whether you call it ML, you call it AI, you call whatever, it will be technology driven. It will be sort of fueled by development in technology. And there, we are not able to predict the pace because it's no longer primarily human dependent.
And Asia, for instance, has been in a very interesting position in terms of technology, because most of us have skipped a lot of technologies because we were late in catching up. Yes. But when we did catch up, we caught up with technologies that were already mature. For instance, let me talk about the whole concept of the LD, you know, the laser disc. That never caught on. By the time people actually were able to afford laser discs, DVDs had already come in. By the time you could buy DVDs, already the digital delivery had become very robust. So, although people do buy DVDs today because there is the higher resolution stuff available, most people are content with downloading or viewing stuff from the internet. Most of us have simply moved on to Netflix and iTunes and Amazon Prime because the delivery systems are so robust. Speeds are so good. The same kind of thing has happened in China, for instance, because they've also hop, skipped and jumped. See, for instance, automation, when it came in, it was a big disruptor. It's a big disruptor only today. But when it came in, nobody thought of automation as a disruptor. Even in high-end hand-finished product lines, there are robotic processes today. For example, if you look at a factory like Dali's, Dali makes high-end audiophile speakers. It is a Danish company. In fact, it stands for Danish Audiophile Loudspeaker Industries. Their speakers are hand-finished in many senses. But much of the precision in cutting, joining, winding coils, and so on is achieved through automation. The reason automation came into these industries is not because it aimed to replace human jobs, but it could achieve precision that humans could not. So you have the same thing in surgery nowadays. Robotics are helping surgeons to reach into complicated areas of the human body with much greater precision. This means less trauma for the patient also, because incisions can be smaller. Now, they are not meant to replace the surgeon today, but who knows what will happen tomorrow. So ultimately, investors realize that profitability too is linked to automation. So China has had a tremendous run in providing tech labor force for electronics giants like Apple. They've had huge assembly lines. Wired, in fact, has made documentaries on the cutting edge innovation that has been happening in the Shenzhen district. But that tech innovation has been people driven to a large extent and has benefited a huge population. Now, China realizes that to stay competitive, they must speed up their assembly lines. And the only way to do that is to replace human labor with automation. So there is a great concern over losing a lot of jobs. And there are many documentaries coming out of China which talk about this. But here's the thing. China's population growth will begin to plateau out for the younger age group. India's, on the other hand, will keep growing. There's this gentleman called Aaron Strandberg, and he's made a very interesting animated infographic that shows this happening over time. A bit like, you know, Rosling's displays.
Right.
Up to the year 2050. India's population far outstrips China's by then. And the population below age 50 is far greater than above. The greatest pressure seems to be in the 2020s and 2030s, when the bulk of the population below age 30 is the highest. So the problem is twofold here in India. How do you stay competitive in the global market and provide jobs at the same time to a huge population that is young and employable?
So that brings me to that second point you had mentioned right at the beginning. What is the nature of the team of the future, and where does that put corporations, just to connect it back to our core theme, where does that put companies in terms of keeping their teams relevant?
See, first of all, if you believe that gig economy is going to be a big disruptor and that people are going to move on from project to project and organization to organization, how are they aligned? What interest does an organization ultimately have in investing in the training of people who just come from a pool of resources? So somebody ultimately has to take on that mantle. So it can be the government, it can be a platform, it can be some other body which says that we are going to take over the training, because the paying organization just believes in getting some output. They are no longer looking at a long-term engagement, and therefore I don't see how they can see value in training. So that's one of the challenges. Remote working too has its own challenges. Initially, everybody thought remote working would, you work from home and that brings you a better work-life balance. But things got more competitive and that did not work out in that way. In fact, productivity seems to have increased for people working from home. At the same time, costs have gone down for organizations because the need for office space, energy consumption, and other office equipment and recurring costs have disappeared. But remote working has brought a new set of challenges, even for the worker. So how do you train the remote worker? People will not be sitting in a room all huddled together. So we will not have the luxury of walking in and conducting a training session. But a more fundamental question remains. So how do you define the team in a gig economy? Because there are no alignments, like I've said earlier. Simply, people move on from project to project. The work ethic becomes dependent on an input-output measure. In such a situation, it is extremely difficult to establish some connect or alignment with broader goals of the organizations.
Well, I see it a little differently. There are two things I'll mention before we wrap this up. One is that I think a lot of the training of the future in the future will be dependent upon the person, because the gig economy is dependent upon self-motivation. That's why one prefers to become a scuba diver part-time and then teach part-time. So a lot of it will be sort of self-motivated. So a lot of the work that typical HR organizations do is about keeping people motivated and focused. That will not be required at all. So the question of aligning for the long run may not be a question, because people who come and join a project group will be extremely motivated to do what they are going to do, and they will not need any external motivation, right? So that's one part. The other part is, till now, training, why do we talk of government or why do we talk of a company? Because training per se has been an expensive proposition. I think where we are headed, you can already see entire curriculum of the Ivy League colleges being available for free. You will not get the certification, mm-hmm. but you can get the knowledge, right? And if right. you pay a very, very little fee, anything between $50, $100, $200, you can get yourself certified. So the point is that the whole mechanism and whole model of education, which is high expense, like you have to go to Harvard for 2 years or whatever, you are talking of $100,000, $200,000, that will not be relevant anymore in the future. So it is actually technology enabled again, where the motivation of the person and his ability to access whatever training he wants, irrespective of the government or the company subsidizing it, will make this whole transition a real one.
Yeah, so one of the prescriptions that's been bandied about for individuals is that, you should be a generalist and not a specialist. Well, not exactly, but that you must go beyond your one specialization area to survive in a world where there is so much of flexibility. So, Robert Heinlein, he wrote fiction, and through one of his fictional characters called Lazarus Long, he had famously said that specialization is for insects. And his statement, of course, has been highly debated, but there are voices that echo this sentiment, especially in the context of the workplace. In a podcast, a very famous podcast called The Joe Rogan Experience, Naval Ravikant says he believes in a multi-specialization, and he talks about this ancient Greek model of life, where you're supposed to do different things in different periods of your life, like going to school, then going to the military, then politics, and then become a philosopher, and so on. So this is the opposite of specialization. Gather more experiences. This is what the gig generation wants as well. This problem of specialization, or rather the false notion of specialization, is also discussed by David Epstein in his book, Range, Why Generalists Triumph in a World of Specialists. So he challenges the idea that specialists with 10,000 hours of practice become virtuosos. This, of course, has been an idea that's been talked about earlier by several other authors. But David shows some data to prove that most success stories in sports as well as other fields, and he's been writing about sportsmen, and he's written another book before about sportsmen. So he's done some research with sportsmen especially. So he shows that in sports as well as other fields, people who have experimented with a variety of work experiences, say with respect to different kinds of athletics, different kinds of sports, are much more successful in becoming virtuosos. So stories that you generally hear of hard, dedicated, specialized training in a particular area are, according to him, just convenient summaries that ignore a lot of the detours these people had to take. The wider the experience, the better your chances at survival. That's basically what he's been saying.
TalentWise is brought to you by KnowledgeBridge. We produce customized and multilingual visual training content. We have worked on complex processes, products, and skills development for large blue-chip brands such as Tata Motors, Mahindra First Choice, Homelane, Epson, Toyota, Citibank, and Consul Neowatt, serving diverse industries. Talk to us for your next custom content requirement and be pleasantly surprised. Call us on 99021-631-32.
Well, I mean, there are points of views and there are points of views. One of the things that I'm getting reminded of while you are talking of these examples is what Cal Newport wrote in Deep Learning, that the only skill that you need is the ability to learn and ability to learn fast. So basically it dovetails into the kind of views that you are talking of. Well, I think it has been an interesting chat, good refresher. Yep. And I hope to do it sometime later in the season with you once more.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good chat.
Thank you for being with us today on TalentWise. We hope we helped you focus on some actionable ideas today. It was certainly enlightening for us. We hope to see you again on our next episode. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and give us a rating while you're at it. Thank you in advance. This Show How To Original podcast is produced for KnowledgeBridge, the multilingual visual training platform and custom training content creators by Show How To Audio. Hosted by Shubhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time.